Peter B. Collins News and Comment for Thursday, March 26, 2015. America's military and surveillance playground, Yemen, descends further into chaos. With the entry of Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and the Gulf Cooperation Council into the conflict in Yemen, like the song says, and pardon my French, we have a full-blown clusterfuck. And I apologize if that term offends you, but I can't think of a better way to describe this. And I was, frankly, a little surprised when I went online to Ardio and found that there are six or seven different songs with this title. But the U.S. playground in Yemen, where we operated at will, we dismissed our puppet dictator, Mr. Saleh, a couple of years ago, and installed a new puppet named Hadi. And we continued to drone and to use special forces against the so-called Al-Qaeda on the Arabian Peninsula. We conducted the drone strike that infamously killed the American Anwar al-Awlaki, and we have operated just any way we want in Yemen. And now the bill is coming due. And with U.S. approval, Saudi Arabia has deployed 100 fighter jets and 150,000 troops. Now, from the reports at this moment, none of those troops have crossed the border into Yemen in any significant numbers. But that's not all. Egypt is providing naval support, deploying 4 warships to secure the Gulf of Aden. The White House said that the U.S. is providing logistical and intelligence support to the Saudi-led forces attacking the rebels. And, as we discussed yesterday, it's a very complicated, fluid situation where the old dictator Saleh is hoping to regain power or maybe install his son, and he is riding, hopefully, back to power, he thinks, on the shoulders of the Houthis, whom he once suppressed and militarily attacked. These kinds of shifting alliances in that part of the world make it even more difficult for the U.S. to figure out who's on our side at a given moment. And the real fluid situation relates to Iran, because Iran backs the Houthi occupation, if you will, of the government of Yemen. And considering that we are relying on Iranian support in Iraq, and we'll get to that story in a moment, considering that we're deep into these talks with Iran about its alleged nuclear intentions, this is a very messy situation. And so, with the introduction of Saudi airstrikes that occurred overnight, we now have a full-blown regional war underway. Yemen is the starting point, but this can easily expand, and it's why I consider it to be sheer madness that Israel, the extreme Zionists in power there, and its allies on both sides of the American political spectrum are eager to attack Iran. That would, in my view, lead to a world war. And the U.S. is ill-prepared after the drain on our forces of the elective wars in Afghanistan and Iraq of the last 12 years. And so this is a very dangerous, very critical situation. And as I said, equally complex. And with the United States tilting along with the Saudis, this makes things even more difficult to try to produce some sort of a peaceful workout. And the Gulf Cooperation Council, which is comprised of Bahrain, Kuwait, Qatar, and the UAR, the United Arab Emirates, is joining the Saudi operation as well. And of the Persian Gulf states, only Oman is refusing to participate. Turkey has indicated its approval. Pakistan and Sudan, they're on board. And so this is a very volatile situation. And as Simon Tisdall in The Guardian analyzes, this is an Iranian-Saudi proxy war, where, of course, the United States is actively involved and often writing the scripts. And this analysis notes that the Houthi rebels were radicalized by the American invasion of Iraq in 2003, and the president at the time, Saleh, attacked these insurgents and tried to suppress them. And as I mentioned, now they are friends, united against the imperialist U.S. of A. It's interesting that the Saudis decided to announce the international coalition in Washington, which clearly shows that their efforts have the blessing of the Obama administration. And I don't think I have too much more to add on this at this point, but I think we need to watch vigilantly and hope that the U.S. doesn't blunder in to another military commitment against these shifting alliances in the Middle East. As I alluded, three major Shiite militia groups that have been working to displace the Islamic State, or Daesh, from Saddam Hussein's hometown of Tikrit, three major militia groups have just put down their guns, said, we're not fighting. Why? Because yesterday, the Baghdad government succeeded in persuading Washington to send in airstrikes. And we bombed the hell out of Tikrit all night long. And then the 5 or 10 aging Soviet aircraft of the Iraqi Air Force took over. Now, the U.S. is only flying at night, only bombing Tikrit at night. And we instructed the Iranian-led Shiite militias to get out of the way. Now, one of the things at play here is that the U.S. and our puppet in Baghdad are very concerned that if the Shiites prevail in displacing the Islamic State from Tikrit, that they will kill the largely Sunni population in that town, and that they will be just as brutal and barbaric as the evildoers of the Islamic State are portrayed in the American media. And this just shows how volatile, how delicate, how out of control the situation is. And we pretend that we're training up these moderates, we're training up the Iraqi army, we're training up the Afghan army. It's all bullshit. And so to hear the allies of Iran who are fighting against the Islamic State in Iraq say they don't need the United States and they refuse to fight while the U.S. is conducting airstrikes in that area. Well, this is captured in a quote from one of the allies of Muqtada al-Sadr, the Shiite, Iran-leaning Iraqi cleric who runs the Mahdi Army, which is now known as the Peace Brigade. He said, we don't trust the Americans. They have targeted our forces many times in so-called mistakes. And this is one of the things that we hear when we get outside of the American media bubble, is that many of the participants believe that the U.S. is secretly supporting the Islamic State and allowing them to continue to fester. So we'll continue to watch this, but it's a very delicate and difficult situation, and I have little confidence that we will come out of this unscathed. I really fear a plunge into a regional war that could lead to a significant international conflict. Like most people, I'm shocked and mystified by what appears to be the intentional crash of German Wings Flight 9525 into the Alps on Tuesday. And it's pretty clear now from the cockpit voice recorder that the co-pilot locked the pilot out of the cockpit and intentionally crashed the plane into the mountains. Of course, we will search for the answer to that question, why? The voice recorder shows that the co-pilot was breathing right up until the moment of impact, suggesting that he didn't have a heart attack or some other calamity that took him out of control, that knocked him out. The other factor is that most likely the plane was on autopilot at that point, and so he had to manually intervene to change the course to send it into that sharp descent that caused it to hit the mountain. So we've learned that the co-pilot is a 27-year-old guy, so a heart attack is unlikely. A stroke, very unlikely. Named Andreas Lubitz. And there are no indications that he had any terrorist links or he was leaning toward Islam or anything like that. In fact, the eerie photograph of Andreas Lubitz shows him at the observation point, the north point, the north side of the Golden Gate Bridge right here in San Francisco. So there's not much more I can add, and of course CNN will go into overdrive on this. And I'll continue to watch to see if there's anything that I think deserves further comment. I want to direct you over to The Intercept because Glenn Greenwald, sharing a byline with Andrew Fishman, really nailed it today. Yesterday, I was laughing at the assertions from Israel that it has not been spying on the United States to figure out the progress in the talks with Iran. It's simply bullshit. And we heard from Netanyahu and others, quote, the state of Israel does not conduct espionage against the United States or Israel's other allies. Well, Greenwald, based on documents supplied by Edward Snowden, cites a 2008 top secret document featuring an interview with the NSA's Global Capabilities Manager for Countering Foreign Intelligence. And when asked who the top threats are to the U.S., he said Russia, China, and Israel. Yes, a national intelligence estimate ranked Israel as the third most aggressive intelligence service against the United States. Later, the document says, one of the NSA's biggest threats is actually from friendly intelligence services like Israel. Specifically, the Israelis target us to learn our positions on Middle East problems. And a different document lists Israel along with other nations that we consider to be hostile. China, Russia, Iran, Cuba, and Israel. I think that case is pretty well closed. In the show file for today's podcast, I have linked to two interesting pieces of commentary that I'd like you to check out. One is from David Glick, who is a member of a group of Jews who support peace in the Middle East. And David Glick, by the way, gave the introduction when I interviewed Professor Richard Falk, and we released that podcast right around Christmas last year. David Glick is a very committed peace activist. And he says, finally, the mask is off. After Netanyahu said, if I'm elected, there will be no Palestinian state. And Glick writes, of course, Netanyahu's actions throughout the entire his entire political career have done everything possible to thwart the emergence of a viable and sovereign Palestinian state. So this is nothing new, except that now he said it clearly and publicly. And he said there's a deeper sense in which the mask is off. The reality is that what Netanyahu stated publicly is what has been true of all of Israel's prime ministers, whether from the left, center, or right. For the past 22 years, all have been lying and misleading the world, pretending to seek peace with the Palestinians while pursuing policies to ensure there will never be peace and never be a Palestinian state. And he regards the talks that have been engaged in over time as a charade. And he offers some interesting historical commentary as well. I hope you'll read the piece by David Glick. Likewise, at Counterpunch, a pal of ours named Henry Noor. Henry used to write for the San Francisco Chronicle until he was fired for attending a protest march against the invasion of Iraq in 2003. He's a good man, and Henry loves radio. He is particularly drawn to NPR. And he said that recently he decided to listen even more critically and to analyze NPR's coverage of the Iranian nuclear controversy, Netanyahu's speech in Washington, and all of those related issues. And he said, "What I found was even more appalling than I'd anticipated." He said that in the last 30 days, there have been a total of 23 segments containing the words Netanyahu and Iran. But in all that coverage, NPR has never found time to tell its listeners, A, that Iran has nuclear weapons, or, for example, that Iran has signed the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty and Israel refuses to sign it. Israel refuses to allow any outside inspection of its nuclear installations. That Netanyahu has been issuing the same hysterical warnings about Iran for more than 20 years? That the Israel lobby is the key force behind the congressional opposition to a negotiated deal with Iran? And that Senator Tom Cotton, in particular, is their man? Those are just some of the key points that Henry Noor discloses from listening to NPR. And he also notices what's missing. For example, that Gareth Porter, a longtime contributor to this program and an expert on Iran, the author of the book Manufactured Crisis. We interviewed him in depth about that last year. Gareth Porter has only been on NPR once. It was in 2008, and it was about Iraq, not about Iran and the nuclear controversies. I don't listen that much to NPR because I don't really find them to be complete. The reporting that they do is good, but it often lacks context and completeness, and Henry Noor has done us a big favor here to point that out. Every day, I like to point out that people support my work here by subscribing to the Peter B. Collins podcast. People like Andy Krieger, Bob Donjakour, Bill Goodacre, and Mona Kobus. Thank you, one and all, for your support. I invite those of you who've never heard your name mentioned as a subscriber to get it together, man. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. Click on the link under my picture that says sign up. Next page, you choose $5, $10, $20 a month, or our best deal, the $50 annual subscription. And that gets you a bonus gift, an ebook edition of Pepe Escobar's new book called Empire of Chaos. And boy, is it very on target with the events that we are covering these days. Yesterday, to little surprise, the military announced that they will be starting a process that could lead to a court-martial of Army Sergeant Bo Bergdahl. He was captured by Taliban forces in Afghanistan in 2009 and, with a 5-to-1 prisoner swap, returned to the U.S. last year. And from the get-go, from the time that the prisoner swap was announced, he has been denounced publicly, sometimes by former people who served alongside of him in Afghanistan, as a deserter. And I'm prepared to let the process go forward and see what the evidence is. Because we know that Bergdahl left his base. And we know that he was captured by the Taliban. But beyond that, we have a lot of innuendo, conjecture, and one-sided accusations. And while his attorney, interviewed on the PBS NewsHour last night, wouldn't really talk much about the details of the circumstances, he did say that Bergdahl was searching for a general officer to whom he could make complaints about the way he had been deployed with his unit in eastern Afghanistan. And so there's a possible substory here that has not surfaced. And like I said, I'm willing to wait and see what the facts truly are. WikiLeaks has done it again by disclosing a very recent draft of the Trans-Pacific Partnership proposed treaty. This trade deal, which is a stinker, is being negotiated in secret. And WikiLeaks has released a version of one chapter that's very fresh. It's only 2 months old. And the most disturbing part of it is not the way it favors corporations over workers. It's not shocking anymore that these trade deals undermine domestic laws. What's really troubling here is that the document includes information asserting that it is top secret and that it may not be declassified until 4 years after the Trans-Pacific Partnership is approved by Congress or after trade negotiations end if the agreement doesn't go through. Now, let's get this. An agreement that's been negotiated in secret, a chapter about the ability of corporations to sue in other countries, which is declared to be kept secret for 4 years after it is approved. How the hell is the Congress supposed to approve a document that has secret chapters? I just find this so bizarre. And the end game of the Trans-Pacific Partnership is a loss of more jobs in the United States and deep undermining of our economy. It is a race to the bottom. And even Chuck Schumer, a pro-corporate, moronic New York senator, is now troubled. It seems to indicate that savvy, deep-pocketed foreign conglomerates could challenge a broad range of laws we pass at every level of government, such as Made in America laws or anti-tobacco laws. I think people on both sides of the aisle will have trouble with this. Well, what about those deep-pocketed American conglomerates, Chuck? They want to take a ride and use the Trans-Pacific Partnership to enhance their power. So I hope that this sunshine, that this exposure of what's going on at the TPP, which we've attempted to draw attention to for years now, will finally get through. And at minimum, they must deny fast-track approval to Obama, and they must demand full disclosure of the entire document, not only to those who will vote on it, but to the American public as well. Anything less is just completely unacceptable. Well, perhaps you've heard that last week, an attorney from Southern California named Matt McLaughlin submitted a proposed ballot measure called the Sodomite Suppression Act to the California Attorney General. The way the process works, you write a ballot measure, you send it to the Attorney General, whose task is to write a title and a fair summary of what the intended language would produce. Now, this attorney is from Huntington Beach, and it happens that when I was on the road last week, I was in Huntington Beach, a beautiful seaside community wedged in between Long Beach and Newport Beach on the Southern California coastline. And I couldn't find this guy, Matt McLaughlin, anywhere. But there I was in Huntington Beach reading about how this local attorney had written this ugly, and I mean, it's clearly unconstitutional, it's illegal, it fails many tests. But his initiative says that he's warning of God's just wrath against us for the folly of tolerating wickedness in our midst. It would require that anyone who touches another person of the same gender for the purpose of sexual gratification be put to death by bullets to the head or by any other convenient method. It would make it a crime punishable by 10 years in prison and permanent exclusion from California to advocate gay rights to an audience that includes minors. The measure would bar gay rights supporters from public office, deny them government benefits, and authorize members of the public to carry out the killings if the state fails to do so within a year. Wow. Now, this is so far off the charts, off the rails, outside of the bounds of decency and humanity. Unfortunately, California law says that only the state Supreme Court can remove unconstitutional measures from the ballot. So Kamala Harris, who is our current Attorney General and who has announced that she'll be running for Barbara Boxer's Senate seat in 2016, is on the hot seat. She's clearly going to offend some extreme evangelicals who probably weren't going to vote for her anyway. But she is caught because all she can do is file a lawsuit in Superior Court in Sacramento and hope that the judge there will rule in her favor. And then ultimately, I believe it would be appealed to the state Supreme Court, which has the authority to remove this piece of doo-doo from the signature gathering process and ultimately prevent it from ever appearing on the ballot here in California. And I hope that process does work in that manner, but we will wait and see. Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. This is the free podcast that you're authorized to share with absolutely everyone. So get going on that, will you? Put it up on Facebook, click the like button. Come on over to Peter B. Collins Show on Facebook and click like there. Thank you very much.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.